chosen from our demand. Still no master snow from the deserts at the hottest sand. And welcome to another amazing episode of the Modern Man Podcast. Here with me today is, this guy is just, I can't believe I haven't had him on earlier, actually. A man I met at an event a couple of years ago, Mr. Winston Davis. We hit it off straight away, a kindred spirit. I've been following him on social media ever since, and he always puts a smile on my face. He's a real interesting character. And in my eyes, a true example of a modern man. He's an actor, an entrepreneur, poet, a community activist, and a guy who gets involved with his local communities and everything else like that, and a family man as well. Winston, welcome to the show.
Hey,
I've kind of given you a that's a big entrance. Isn't it?
I'm not sure I can live up to that.
All right, man. Give us a little bit about yourself, man.
Okay. Currently, I'm a heating engineer. That's what I do day to day. I'll tell you how I got there. So born a single parent family, me and brother and sister. Went off and studied. I went to university. Whilst I was in university, I was on the wrong side of the law. So I was, getting in trouble and, drinking and fighting and, generally not behaving myself. Yeah. And I ended up graduating from university and went to work in Belfast. So I was an account manager in Belfast. And then I lost my job because I was cocky young man. And I come to a head when I think it was the office manager asked me to pick up a piece of paper off the floor. And I was just like, nah, I'm not the cleaner. I'm not picking up anyone's paper. So anyway, I ended up losing my job. And within 4 months of coming back from Belfast, I was in maximum security prison.
Okay.
So I've gone from one extreme to the other, it was, and that was a real wake up call. The reason I went to prison, I was stopped in a car by police officers with 30 kilos of skunk marijuana.
Not personal then.
Not personal. front seat, back seat, boot. You couldn't fit in anywhere else. And I was arrested one day. The next day, I said I was in a maximum security prison. Sentenced to 3 years. And literally from day one, I was just there. When I walked out on the landing for the first day, and I was just like, what am I doing here? I'm an educated guy. I've been to university. I don't belong here. And over the course of the sentence, that same question just kept coming back to me, what am I doing here? What's this all about? And invariably, the answer that I ended up getting back was that I was just there to learn. I was there to grow. I was learning to learn about myself, to learn about other people, and to just to develop as a human being. And it's crazy because when you're locked away like that, you get to see people under a microscope. So you get to see very, very worst of society, and you get to see some really cool people that you would never get to meet anywhere else, and just to see what makes them tick and what what it is that they have about themselves has got them to where they are. And I said it's really interesting to see, and I learned masses about said people and myself while I was there. While I was there, I also did a training course, and it was a gas course at the open prison where I finished up. And at the time, I didn't actually really see myself having a career in it. I just thought, it's good training. It'd be another qualification to have, and just something to do.
Yeah.
But then when I came out of prison, I tried getting a job back in doing what I was doing. So I was calling up, companies and people that I knew from the industry, and
Yeah.
It was like, wow, like, these doors are not open. There are no open doors. There's no way back in. You know, it's a small world and word travels fast.
Yeah.
The option of getting back into doing what I was doing just wasn't there.
Was that just as much the reason for you, like your criminal record, or was it because of what happened in the job beforehand as well?
No, the criminal record.
Yeah, right.
You know, I remember I went for an interview somewhere, and they wanted me to work. It was in West London. I was living in East London, and they wanted me to work until like 6:30. So I had a tag on my ankle for the last.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I basically thought, you know what? I may as well just come clean with them, because if not, this is going to cause me problems. So I said, look, I've got to tell you something. I've just come out of prison. I've got a tag on my ankle. And it didn't go down well. They didn't appreciate the honesty anyway. So it was kind of like, you know, I just met my then to be wife, and the question was being asked, you know, what are you doing? You know, what, you know, are you getting a job? Are you working? You know, what's your plan? So I ended up then thinking, actually, you know what? What about this gas training I've done? I've done this training. Why don't I try and, you know, try and do something, even just in the meantime, while I get this tag off? So I rang around a few companies. Again, no one was taking anyone on. And eventually I spoke to a friend who was working in the company, and I just said to him, look, can you tell your boss that I'll come down and work for free? I don't want to get paid. I just want to work.
Yeah.
And literally called me back 10 minutes later and was like, look, you can start tomorrow. And so I came down, never done any manual work in my life. And I was thrown in a council estate in East London, you know, hanging and picking up radiators and taking out boilers and just, you know, being a dog's body.
Yeah.
But what was funny is that I started there and I actually found, I'm quite enjoying this. This is all right. And I actually then started working really hard, and I would be literally running around these houses. There's like teams of guys in the house, like five, six guys in the house, one doing a bathroom, one doing a boiler, one doing a water cylinder. And I would run around and I'd be helping all of them. So I was like, Winston, come here, Winston, come there. And I'd be running to all of them. But what I found is that my main job was to fit radiators. So I'd have between 5 and 8 radiators to fit in a day. But what I found was if I could finish fitting radiators quickly, so by like 1 o'clock or even 12 o'clock, that meant for the next 4 hours, I got to go around helping other people and learning about what they're doing, because what they're doing is going to help me. And the guys, we used to come on breaks, and the guys, some of them would laugh, and it's like, and I'll come out sweating, and I'll be like, I'm not really, don't want to take a break, or to carry on in there. And they'll be saying, Winston, why are you working so hard? And it's like, I'm trying to get somewhere. And they're like, but why? You're not even getting paid. And it's like, they just didn't understand that for me, it wasn't about the money. It was about, this was an opportunity to change my life.
Yeah.
And within a month of starting there, the boss come up to me and was like, look, I can't not pay you. I've got to pay you something. You work too hard not to pay you. So he started paying me like £40 a day, which basically covered food and my travel. And then after like 6 months, I then went back and did the exams and got qualified. And basically fast forward 3 years later, within 3 years, I had got qualified, set up my own business. And out of about, I don't know, say 10 of the guys that used to work in this company, probably about 7-8 of them either were working for me at the time or had worked for me between that time. So when they had been laughing, like, why are you working so hard? They didn't obviously see the vision that I saw in that, actually, if I work really hard, because what I recognized really early was that there's a lot of good engineers out there and a lot of good people that can do the job, but not necessarily they understand business.
I understand.
So I was like, well, if I can bring business with this skill set, I can do well. And, you know, that's what I ended up doing. So set up the business, And, you know, we ended up with up to 20 guys working, project managers. We was doing hotels for Stelios Easy Hotel. We was doing schools, photography studios, doing all kinds of work all over, like, you know, Hampstead, Chelsea and Kensington, all these sort of areas of London. And things were good. And it was during this time that I had a little bit more time to myself, because I'd set the structure up now. So yeah. I didn't have to be involved all day, every day. And I said to my wife, I'm thinking about going back to acting, because she knew I did acting before we met. And her response was, why do you want to do that? You're not going to become Brad Pitt.
That's a limiting belief.
So I just shut up from that moment. I didn't say anything. I just kept quiet. And then I ended up sneaking off during the days for the next 9 months, going to acting classes without telling my wife. And then what happened was, I went to meet a friend of mine who was an agent, and she was like, look, you know, why don't I, you know, sort of take you on under my agency? And I was like, yeah, cool. So that was like the Friday. She took some photos of me and called me back later on and said, oh, I've got you an audition. And I was like, okay. And she was like, what's it for? She goes, oh, Game of Thrones. I was like, oh, what's that?
I saw that the other day. You posted that, didn't you?
Yeah. So she was like, yeah, Google it. So I Googled it. On the Monday, I went to the audition. And then on the Friday, I got a call back from my agent. She said, oh, you've been penciled. And I was like, what does that mean? She goes, it means you might have got it. And I was like, oh, cool. Well, anyway, at this time now, my wife is like eight and a half months pregnant with our youngest son. And we went to the hospital on Sunday, and the hospital said, right, baby's got to come early. There's complications. We've got to bring the baby early. We could have a cesarean on Tuesday coming. So 48 hours, we're going to have a cesarean. So obviously we're, you know, really happy and excited. The next day, my agent calls me on a Monday and says, yeah, Winston, you've got the role in Game of Thrones. You've got to fly to Croatia tomorrow. And I'm thinking, what, Tuesday? I'm like, Tuesday? I was like, I'm going to have to call you back. So then I spoke to my wife, and it was like, come clean time. So I'm like, look, I've been acting, and I've got this role, and they want me to go fly tomorrow. Anyway, there was a few tears and whatever. I spoke to my agent again and said, look, you know, we're meant to have this baby tomorrow. She ended up speaking to the production team, and luckily they let me fly out on a Wednesday.
That is a good as excuses you're going to have there, isn't it?
That's what I'm saying. So yeah, literally that was like, you know, most amazing week of my life. And things were great. You know, things were, you know, growing wonderfully. I suppose a side caveat I probably should put in is that during the whole of this time, so since I was released from prison, my eldest son was conceived while I was on day release.
That's what day release is for, isn't it?
Well, actually, my oldest son was released on day release. I also was conceived on day release. A week later, I met my wife on my last ever day of day release.
Wow.
And a week later, I got out, and me and my wife just hit it off. But a month after getting out, I got a call from my ex to say that she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'd met my wife. So when my eldest son was born, it basically has been very difficult. So all the time since my eldest son has been born, it's been difficult trying to see him. So I've been going through the court for all of this period, even up to very recently. So I was saying, things were going well from the point of the Game of Thrones, and the business was, you know, flowing in that time. Things were great. And literally that was 2016. So then where were we then for 2015? So then a year and a half after that, on a 2.5 years after that, that's when it all literally imploded on me again. Now I was flying high. I was like, so I'd had a business, I was doing my acting, I was going out doing these motivational talks and mentoring, and I was just like, you know, life's great. And then literally all of a sudden, 2017, it just all completely crashed, you know, and things went, I turned down an offer to sell my business in mid-2016, and at the start of 2017, literally, things fell off the cliff. The business basically started going downhill, and I lost the business 2017. I lost our home, and it's like from hero to zero. All of a sudden, we haven't got all these people working. All of a sudden, we haven't got the money coming in. And I literally, 2017 was a year where I had to learn, again, it was like being back in prison. I had to learn again. I had to learn more about myself, more about the world, more about what it is that's important to me, Yeah. So prior to that with the business, I was constantly on the go, constantly working, from early in the morning, I'm thinking about business, and it's like, physically I wasn't working on tools, but it's the mental stress of it and the mental strain of it.
So what caused the breakdown in the business? Was it just your focus level, or was it actual business conditions, or what were you making mistakes? What was going on?
So the main word for the failure of the business is lack of control.
Right.
So we had no control over our staff, control over materials, control over cash flow. So we had guys that were turning up late, an hour, leaving an hour early. If you've got 10 guys doing that, that's 20 working hours in a day.
Yeah.
These are London rates. And if you're losing that, every day or 4 days of the week, that's a lot of money you're losing. And said no control over materials. So, we ended up with by the end of the business, I had three garages full to the brim of plumbing material, thousands, tens of thousands of pounds of material, which I just couldn't use. And it was just being overordered, where every day the material was coming through, and we were just signing it off. We don't know what they need or don't need. You've got 8 or 9 sites running.
Wow.
So yeah,
lessons
just
in there, then.
Yeah, huge lessons in there. Huge lessons. But again, when you come through those kind of experiences and you come out the other side, it's like, do you know what? Now I'm just thankful. I'm just thankful for being here and to to wake up every day and to. No, to be with my family. Yeah. Every day. Listen, it's funny, when things are going wrong in your life, you start to look outwards to find out, what it is where you can get help. And, religiously now, I get down, in the morning, I pray. The first thing I do before I do anything in the morning is I pray. And I just thank God for being here and what blessings I do have, despite whatever else is going on, And I think that's a massive thing. And actually, when we met at that event, there was a coach there, a happiness coach. And she did an exercise with us, suggested that at the end of each day, you think of 5 things that made you happy.
I
followed that through. I probably don't do it every night, but I probably do at least 5.
It's a powerful, powerful exercise. Joe's a good friend of mine. She's I follow it.
So literally, and it's like just shifting that perspective of let's think about what we're grateful for, not what we haven't got. And then when you start doing that, it makes life so much easier.
So gratitude for me, I do a talk called How to Die Happy. I did that when I was a will writer. And there were 6 things that were really, really important, different aspects of life. And one of them was happiness. But within that is understanding where happiness comes from and how to create it within yourself. And I got the answer to that by going and speaking to old people. When I was doing will instructions, I used to go and speak to old people. And I always used to ask them what they thought what the key to their longevity was. And they always say things like they'd been lucky or whatever. When I drilled down, they hadn't been lucky at all. They had just felt lucky. Right, they felt blessed. Mm-hmm. However you want to put it, they had gratitude. Mm-hmm. Right, they were grateful for the little things that were going on in their life. And once I realized that, and I started doing this as a talk, the penny didn't really drop until I started trying to explain it to other people. and the more you say it and you repeat it, you're like, "Hang, this is deep shit." Actually, the key to happiness is gratitude for me within. Yeah. when you look around yourself and you're just like, thank you for that. I'm so happy I've got that. Look at these little things. And it doesn't matter when you get train yourself to do that. It doesn't matter how little you've got or how shit things are around you. You focus on the good things that are going on and the good things. So with my coaching clients now, ask all of them that I piss them right off, especially when they first start working with me. Because at the beginning of every single call, I say to them, right, what's been good since the last time? And they start off every time. It's a real struggle. They're like, oh, I can't think. I don't know. I'm going to have to. And then like a couple of weeks later, they're like, I know how to get them. I'm going to start writing stuff down throughout a week. So they start writing and they get all these lists. And even then I drill them and drill them. I spend the first 15, 20 minutes of every coaching session just going, talk to me about what's been good. What's been good? What are you grateful for? You know, and the stuff they come out with, you know, and you just see them light up with it and the contentment. They're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Didn't think about that. And it just, for me, it's a really important thing, gratitude. And whenever you speak to someone like yourself who's figured out this stuff or whatever on their path, whenever you meet somebody who is genuinely enlightened or whatever, and you ask them, that is part, gratitude is part of it in different ways.
Huge.
It will always be part of whatever they're doing as in their life. They'll be thankful and grateful. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. Right. Listen, that was an amazing story. So but we need to go back a little bit because I got a deep dive into some stuff, man. On a personal level, I can relate to pretty much every aspect of your journey. I've been through something similar, although I never got caught. I think that's probably the biggest difference between us and these little journeys. I've lost businesses. Family struggles with stuff like that. One of the things I am keen to speak to you about actually is prison. This is the Modern Man podcast, and there is something about prison that is, I mean, it's like, what is it, 92% of the prison population are men? It's ridiculous. So it's almost a uniquely male situation. One of the other things, I watched a program recently about where they went inside the prison, and they were up in Durham, and they had these guys from Derby, and they were proper geezers, mind. They'd both been banged up. They were mates from outside, but they'd been banged up for 15 years or something like that. And they had real reputations. They were like running the prison, and they were coming close into their like last year or whatever. And they moved them up to Durham, and they completely changed. They were like, wow, you know, we can relax here. We've got no pressure on us to be the top guys. No one wants to fire us. We don't need to prove ourselves here. We can just have a little quiet life. And they went through this thing, and as they were up there for like 6 months, and then the authorities wanted to move them back, and they were going, don't do that to us. We're just up here chilling now. Finally, we can just like, we can read, but you know, we haven't got a fight. We haven't got to get in trouble. Yeah. And then right in the last minute, they were allowed to stay up there. And then as they were about to be released, one of them especially started self-sabotaging because he was freaking out so much about coming out. Anyway, watching this program made me realize, like, certainly with my new head on, I've got a lot of friends who have been inside. It's not something we particularly talk about, really. But it made me realize how it is that real primitive, fundamental, masculine situation, isn't it? Like, it's down to, but it's about survival. It's about toughness. It's about front bravado. Physicality, you know, some of it is physicality, it's not always, but some of it's physicality. But at the very least, you've got to be strong of mind and be able to fight mentally with other people so that you can survive. You know, they put you into that environment almost deliberately to bring out that all of those real base elements of masculinity. And what's your experience of that? I'm keen to see what your take is on that.
My experience of survival.
Yeah, I mean, is that what it's like? I've never been in there. I have spoken to my mates about it, but I've never gone that deep.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say, I mean, particularly when I was in maximum security, you know, it's like I've not been in the army, but I could imagine it being what it might be like to be in a combat zone.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly on guard. Yeah. You know, the only time that you can relax a little bit is when you're in your cell, in your bed, and the door's locked. But you can't even relax completely there if you've got a cellmate, because you don't know what they're going to end up doing to you in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And you don't know when that door's going to get, you know, flung open and whoever's going to come barging in. So yeah, you're constantly on, you know, tenterhooks. You're constantly being aware. You know, you go for a shower and you want to make sure that, you know, see who's on the landing, who's around, who might be having a look to see when you're going in by yourself. You know, is there anyone planning to do anything to you? And then you've got that whole thing of, like you said, about the psychology of it. So I remember there was one incident, and it's it goes. You talk about the baseness of it is that because you're stripped, you have nothing. So you don't even have your name. You don't have your first name. You either got your surname or you've got your prison number. That's what you referred to. You never referred to by your first name. And so possessions become really like even more magnified of wanting it. So like, you know, that's why when you might see someone sell and they've got everything all immaculately laid out and pristine, and they're, you know, they're really looking after, you know, their cereal boxes, or, you know, their milk's all lined up in a nice way, you know, whatever it is. And I remember this guy coming into the cell, and I was just on my I was just on my bunk, and this guy's come in, and he's like, yeah, he just, because he knows me as Taylor, and he's like, yeah, Taylor, I'm just taking some paper. And I'm like, I've stopped and I'm looked and I'm thinking, sorry. Like, and he didn't ask me. He just started taking the paper out of my pad. And I've looked at him and I'm thinking, like, what do you mean you've taken my paper? This is my paper, you know? Yeah. And I stopped him and I said, don't touch my paper. Leave my paper there. And he's like, shut up. He said, I'm taking it. Anyway, and he's gone to walk out of my cell. So I'm like, listen, I tell you now, you can put that paper back, we're going to have a problem. And he was sort of thinking I was bluffing, and it was a bit said, it was sort of like he's testing my space, you know, testing what I was about, because I was only just got to the prison recently, and he, you know, he's trying to either, you know, so because it starts with that, someone starts take
the paper, yeah.
Next minute, you'll be giving away all the food that you. So, and I recognize that. So literally he's got to the cell door, and I've jumped down off the bunk, and I'm like, listen, what do you want to do? And he sort of starts fronting me up, and my cellmate was in the cell shaving, and he's looked at me through the mirror, and I said, look, you're going to have to leave. So he didn't say anything. He just took his shaver. I think his shaver was still on his head, like towards his face. And he just sort of scurried out of the cell. And then, yeah, the guy had to shut the door and we had to sort it out. And it's kind of like, you know, that's, you know, all over a piece of paper. You know, one of us could have been seriously injured.
Yeah.
Over a sheet of paper.
But it is more than that, isn't it? It is.
More than that.
It's more than that. But, yeah, it's interesting that it comes down to that, and that men are being forced into this situation where they have to act out that thing, like you said, on the surface of it, over a bit of paper.
But it's not that, you know. And then you've got the whole thing about groupings, you know, like it's so you see it, like they portray it massively in the American films, you know, you've got your Aryan Brotherhood gang.
Yeah, the gangs on race. Yeah.
But in prison, it is that, you know, like, and it's so defined of you are with your group. So you've got your Muslims with one group, and you've got your traveler guys in one group, you know, your black guys in one group. Like, everyone's defined into their groups, you know, and it's like, then that's when you've got, you know, if something happens with one, then that's when everyone's going to fight against each other, you know, and it can go off so quickly. It can go off so quickly, you know, over, like I said, over things that you think are nothing. But all of a sudden, you've got this swirling of, there's something in the air. You know it's going to kick off. You know something's going to happen. And again, it's like being in that combat zone, and all of a sudden it's off, and you've got all of the alarms going off. All of the all of the officers come running through. You know, people are getting rugby tackled. You know, blood pouring everywhere, and it's like, you know, you've got people screaming, and all of a sudden, it then gets quashed and curled down. But you're like, okay, that might have been over, but when's the next one going to start?
Yeah.
So
it is though, but look, like, that's all like real. It is almost primitive, isn't it? It's real basic human shit, and especially it's what men have been doing since the dawn of time. Getting your groupings, and we do it. And you do it outside, you know, whether it's from what city you're from, what area, what postcode, what football team you support. Guys like to get into groups of similar whatevers and front up against other guys. It's like it seems like natural for us to do that.
And obviously, and without you know, so like at school, it might happen a bit, but then you've got girls around you to calm things down. But when there's no one to calm things down, and if anything, a lot of the officers want to rile it up anyway.
Well, yeah.
You know, so you can't tar all officers in the same way, because there's some that were actually decent and actually cared, but there's some that are just, you know, misogynistic, or, you know, just want to see blood and they want to see badness and they want to be horrible. And those kind of officers are the ones that want to rile it up. And there's no peeling back, you know. So it's either someone so badly hurt or killed that it stops, or officers intervene and it gets broke up for a period of time. You know, it's just, it's a crazy, crazy environment.
So you got 3 years. Is that how long did you actually spend in?
So just under a year and a half.
Okay.
Just on the last bit on tag.
And one of the things that I was coming to at the end of the story of watching this guy was right before they were about to let him out, the last couple of days, he started self-sabotaging because he didn't want to come out. Mm. He'd been in there for nearly half his life, like 15 years or whatever, and he started freaking out about what it was going to be like outside. I guess that doesn't happen to you, that level of institutionalism doesn't really happen to you in a year and a half. But I guess, was there still like a fear of, was it?
100%. Well, you talk about that guy self-sabotaging. I tell you a story briefly about a guy who I knew at the open prison. He had served 5 years, and he was due to get out, I think it was like a month later. And he went out on day release, and he got arrested for, I think it was stealing a packet of bacon out of Tesco's.
Yeah.
Where obviously he just didn't want to get out. So by doing that, it meant obviously then he wasn't released. But yeah, when I got out, I went and stayed with my dad. And where my dad lives, there's like an estate and there are bars on his windows. And I got out, and I literally, about 2 days after getting out, I rang up my probation officer and I said to him, look, I want to go back in and just finish my time off, because I can't do this, like being locked up. And it was like, literally, like I was in my dad's, but I felt like I was in even more of a prison than I was in an open prison. Because at least in an open prison, you can walk around outside of your hut or whatever it is, dorm, at a certain time. You're not confined. And I felt massively back to being confined again. And actually, ever since being in prison, I can't, it drives my wife crazy. The second I open my eyes, I have to get out of bed. I can't stay in bed. I have to get out. And most of the time I get out and I go. So I'll go to the gym or I'll go for a walk. I cannot stay in. I've got to get out before I can start my day. Yeah. And I know that's come from then, you know. It's like, I don't know, you're for me, it's like that mental programming of being
Yeah. Once you've done something over and over again, you've kept a habit, it would take quite a bit of work to undo it. But I reckon it's probably quite a useful habit, isn't it?
I enjoy it. I get up, yeah. You know, and I said, although, yeah, it annoys my wife. I think it's a positive outcome.
100%. So, like, you when you were in there, you like you you've learned a lot from what, when you were first describing your time in there. What it seemed to me was that you've taken a load of positives from that year and a half. Is that the case?
100, literally, yeah. It's one of the best things that ever happened to me. It's, wow. I kind of needed it.
Yeah.
It's like, up until that point, I was coasting. I never put any real effort in my life. I never put real effort into anything. I just sort of got by on my, you know, my intellect and whatever, and I just coasted. And when you fail, so massively fail as I failed, it hit you and you're like, wow, you know, what is this all about? And another thing that hit me was, if I die in here, what legacy do I leave on this world? What do I leave? What is there that I've been here? Who knows that I've been here? And I think that's, you know, a massive thing of, so when I got out, well, I was so determined to turn things around and, you know, meet my wife and to, you know, get on with having a family, you know, and I think, I'm not saying that I wouldn't have been successful without it, but I certainly wouldn't have met my wife when I met my wife. I certainly definitely wouldn't have become a, you know, involved in the heating business. It just wouldn't happen, you know? So there's no matter what, and this is another thing I massively believe in, that everything happens for a reason. So I went there for a reason, and I can try and pick out the reasons for it consciously and logically, but probably a lot of them aren't even going to be shown to me. But definitely meeting my wife, getting a new business, getting a new perspective on life, it was a massive necessity for me, you know. And
I often look back, because when you said a few things, and like I said, so much of what you said I can really relate to, like being a cocky young man, the whole thing of your boss telling you to get pick the paper up. I was that guy. It's pretty much why I've been self-employed or been doing my thing all of my life, because whenever I went for a job at night, I was that guy. And it makes me wonder what you just said then, is that you needed it and it gave you a real kick up the ass, and that I wonder if I'd have ever been stopped at that age, what it would have done for me. But obviously, as you said, everything happens for a reason. There is a reason why it didn't for me. Do you get what I mean? Like, I learned other stuff anyway. I had to figure out, I didn't get that short, sharp shock. I've had to slowly figure it out, and it's taken me until 40, ready to really to get to grips with a lot of the stuff that I could have learned. So you were in the maximum security prison. You survived it.
Yeah.
You get out into the open prison. They let you out on day release.
Yeah.
You use your day release for what day release is for.
Yeah.
So the girlfriend you had, your first, is it your son?
My oldest son, yeah, yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. Did you meet her while you were, before you went to prison, or?
Yeah. No, we met years before. So we had a sort of on-off relationship probably for about 5 years, maybe. You know, in my mind, it was very much, you know, going to be off. You know, things happen. You know, my son was conceived.
But and then you met your now wife, like,
yes.
So obviously the ex is now, she's pissed off, right?
Yes.
And that's still causing a problem.
Not now. Well, I mean, still causing a problem in the fact of, I basically spent 7 straight years in the family courts, representing myself, fighting to prove that my son was mine, to get the DNA test done, fighting to see him, to have contact with him, just constantly fighting, you know, every step of the way. You know, I've had over 25 court appearances. I've just had loads and loads of different times to try and fight the battle to see my son. But what we got down to in the end was, over the last sort of 7 months, is the family court system is set up in a way that it's not in favor of fathers. And, you know, people might disagree with me, but it's not, you know, fathers, in this country, we and actually, and this is another thing I found, it's not just this country, it's throughout the world, yeah. are now sort of second class parents, where the status quo is that children, the authorities believe children should be with their mothers rather than the fathers as a first port of call.
It's an interesting thing because it's a little kind of change of perspective that I've been sitting on for quite a while. Because obviously in my work with men and in the man club and stuff like that, this is probably one of the major issues for men in this country is the whole issue of not being able to see their kids and the difficulties and you know, not living with them and this issue. What someone said to me is actually it's not fathers. What it is the non-resident parent. So, because I've come across loads of women that are the same, but because of the way our society is structured, normally the kids start off, the resident parent is the mother and the father is the non-resident parent. Yeah. Which just made me, it seems like it's a situation that isn't particularly driven towards the sex or the fatherness. It's the societal construct that we've got where women have got the kids now. Do you know what I mean? To start off with. But yeah. Still, it affects us over a ridiculous amount. So you fought this battle for 7 years.
Yeah, so 7 years I fought it, and it got to the point of there's a thing called enforcement, an enforcement right. application that you can make to the court because orders yeah. aren't being made. And the vast majority of the time, orders are never enforced. So an enforcement...
No, they're not.
They're not. So I basically went to court and I argued, and my son's mother had a barrister there, and I basically represented myself and I deconstructed their argument, and an enforcement order was made in my favour. My son's mum was fined, and there was a thing called a penal notice was attached to the order. But the fact was, it did nothing, and it basically continued to be flouted and continued to be to basically have problems trying to see my son. And it got to the point where the courts said earlier this year that they are so worried about my son because of the emotional abuse that he may be suffering, or the emotional harm is what the word they use. They're worried about the emotional harm that he may be suffering, that they wanted social services to get involved and to do what's called a Section 37 report to ascertain whether or not he's at risk of suffering severe emotional harm, and whether or not he should be removed from his mother's care and you know, potentially moved into my care. And this is what I'd been saying for a number of years prior to this, is that my son is suffering from what is called parental alienation.
Yep.
Now, parental alienation is where one parent, predominantly the resident parent, and predominantly women, but not
yep. exclusive, yeah, it is.
Turn a child against the non-resident parent. And I've been saying for a number of years, this is the case, and it's been alluded to in reports by the CAFCAS child protection people that alienation is taking place, but they haven't explicitly said it. Now, interesting, just the other day, the World Health Organization, for the first time ever, have now categorized parental alienation as a basically a form of abuse. It's now been officially categorized because of what happened was when the social services got involved, I said to the social officer when she came to do the interviews, are you aware of parental alienation? And she said, no, I'm not. She asked me what it is. What is it? And I said, well, is there not a department in the social service that deal with it? And they said, no. And I said, so nobody in social service knows what parental alienation is? She said, no. So I said, how can you deal with this case?
Oh.
So they basically couldn't deal with the case and couldn't award my son to come to live with me, which I didn't say was the best thing for him. I said the best thing is that his mum looks after him, but she's supported in what she does. And ultimately, because they couldn't award that, another hearing we had last month, I basically got to a point and I said, you know what, enough is enough. I walked in there and said to the court and said to my son's mum, I read out a 5-page statement and just said, I'm so disappointed with this whole system is broken. And it's got to the point where my son is now so severely emotionally and psychologically damaged by the whole of these proceedings for such a long period of time, that someone has to put a stop to this, and I'm going to do that today, and I'm now going to stop seeing my son. So I've taken a drastic decision to stop seeing my son, but with the view that I feel that it's in his best interest as it stands, because no matter what the judges would order, his mum wouldn't be following that, and mm-hmm. she would continue the abuse by and it's like I said, these things are like subliminal, because in the court, his mum was saying, you're blaming me, this isn't to do with me. And I actually genuinely believe that she is not aware that she's been abusing him, that she's not aware that by turning him against me is actually abuse. By turning him against me was not even explicitly saying it, but it could just be how she engaged with me in his presence, or how
it's a huge problem.
So these kind of things are what
causes the even the damage that's done. Speaking as a therapist, the biggest issues that people have to overcome when I take people back using timeline therapy and stuff like that, we go back to when people decide things about themselves, like not being good enough, they're not worthy, all of this stuff. These decisions are made way back when, and the power of their formative years and the way that their parents are with each other and towards them, and the power of the words that are used, the impact is lifelong. We cannot underestimate this stuff. And like you said, like parental alienation, I've seen it. I've had a couple of clients who've suffered from it. My ex-wife, I help her. She runs a business that provides support for social workers. So she actually goes in and does parenting assessments. She does provide support for supervised contact and stuff like that. So I'm fully aware of what's going on the ground with all of this. And like you said, it's broken, and we're going to have a generation of kids, of our children, of our generation, that are going to have all kinds of stuff, because they said that negativity going in, like they don't just take it as being their parent is bad, they will take a part of that onto themselves. Do you know what I mean? Because if he's bad and I'm part of him,
100%. This is exactly it.
Yeah.
And the whole point of this part of his alienation is that basically the children, psychologically, their brain can't handle what's going on. So what they do is, it's a term called splitting. So their brain basically splits into compartmentalizing parents as either wholly good or wholly bad. And they basically see the alienator as wholly good, and the parent as being alienated as wholly bad.
Yep.
And then obviously by on a unconscious level, by saying that they're bad, they know that's, like I said, that's part of them. So they must be them.
Yeah, for sure. Damaging, man. So part of this, obviously, one of the reasons for me reaching out is was recently seeing your video on there with what's the name of the organization?
Families Need Fathers.
Families Need Fathers. Yeah, it was very moving for me. It's really kind of like powerful. So you met some other dads that have been through the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a member of Families Need Fathers now for about a year and a half, and what it basically offers support groups all over the country where fathers can get together. And I say fathers because it's not just exclusive fathers. So I keep saying fathers. I'm sorry, and if there's any women listening, because it's not just fathers. It's not exclusive for fathers. This issue is not exclusive for fathers. But we meet at support groups and basically offer advice about legal matters, care arrangements, what to do in certain situations. I've met and now actively help many dads that are going through separation or trying to see their child. One of them is in enforcement hearing today, and you're just trying to give them support for themselves to get through it. So after spending so many years in the system, so to speak, I'm in a position now where I am very experienced and able to, help people, because it's so tough. And if I wish that I had found, this resource and this organization earlier in my journey. So I feel a massive importance to support it and to support, other people that are going through it. But I went to a protest last month for parental alienation. and that's the National Association of Alienated Parents. I went to support them, you know, because it's a collection. It's, you know, next month I'm going to support Fathers of Justice at an event that they're hosting. And I feel like, you know, obviously we are small organizations in our own right, but we have to support one another because it only works if it is a collective. And yeah, I've met so many dads, and the stories I hear, you know, they're both heartbreaking and inspiring. You know, some very few dads actually end up with, you know, custody of their children, and others that are able to have 50-50 shared care. And actually, you know, people like you that are actually able to co-parent. I mean, what a beautiful thing it is to be able to put your children before your own needs and desires. You know, that's such a massive thing.
I feel lucky. I mean, don't get me wrong. My first daughter, her mum, that was a tough time. Similar things. I spent 7 years. I was living in Spain at the time. Without fail, every single month I've travelled to Bedfordshire to go and see her. Whether I've been able to or not is beside the point. But certainly for the first 7 years, that was tough. I was living in Spain. I used to fly back, hire a car from Bristol, drive down to Bristol, get there. I went through it, and I know it's been worth it because I've now got a relationship with my daughter. I was just persistent. When she met somebody else, everything chilled out a lot, and now our relationship is great. And with my ex-wife now, we've both been in the positions that we are, me with as a modern man and her in her job. We kind of haven't had any choice. We've got to represent ourselves on a professional level.
Yeah,
I remember listening to. So there's a couple of things. I remember when I first moved out, I started looking for resources as a divorced man. Where can I get some advice on how to do this? And there was so little of it there. Actually, so many of the resources were there for women and by women. Very little support apart from like some angry guys. You know what I mean? Like, oh, don't move out of the house. Don't do this. They're out to get you. Like, there's a lot of that. But there wasn't any like practical, you know, this is how we do it. So I was listening to some podcasts, some women's podcasts. I remember one phrase really stood out to me. And she was saying, instead of putting the kids in the middle, put them in the center. And I was just like, that's critical, that difference between putting the kids in the middle of your divorce. Do you know what I mean? No. You put them in the center. They're the center. They're the focus. Everything else comes out from that. Do you know what I mean? What is the starting point for any discussion that you have is what is best for the kids.
Yeah, 100%.
What is best for the kids? And then you sort out the other stuff around that. And that was really useful for both of us. And I kept that in mind. We've had a very amicable breakup, as amicable as they can be. And the kids have benefited from that. To be fair, some of it has actually made it harder on us, I think. Like, being so friendly, sometimes you just, like, it would be much easier if you just hated each other, because you just know where you stand then. It's much cleaner. But for the kids' sake, yeah, it was cool. I had my daughter yesterday and today, and one of the first times, I really didn't want her to go. She's 12, my youngest one. I struggled with it today. I'd had just such a nice couple of days. She's at a difficult age, and it's been up and down with her spending time with me. As a teenager or whatever, but we've just had a really nice couple of days, and we started like settling into a routine. And I took the day off yesterday, and we went to the seaside sort of thing, and went on a theme park rides and everything else. And today I was really. She's not a very huggy kid, like, you know. She came and gave me a hug, like, and was just like, I've had a really good time. That's the first time she's ever done that. Like, and I was like, oh man, yeah. I got quite choked up. I was just like, it really, it struck me today. That was today. So you've decided to walk away from the fight. How old is your son?
9.
He's 9. All right. Mm-hmm. You've got other children now with your current wife?
Not just my current wife, my wife that I've got for my rest of my life, yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
current, like, you know, at the moment. So with my wife, I've got an 8-year-old and I've got a 4-year-old, all boys.
All right, cool. So the hope is that one day your son's just going to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the idea. I mean, at the court hearing, I said, look, you know, let's have a minimum of a year of no contact whatsoever. And, you know, and the judge was trying to talk me around and, you know, look at other avenues. But for me, it was like, we just needed a break, you know, complete. Yeah. And I said a year, but, you know, that realistically, that probably will end up being, you know, 5, 6, 10 years. We don't know, because I just feel that he needs space just to not have to be put through this. It's just not fair on him.
That is a big man decision, mate. That is a big man decision. I applaud you for it.
It's one of the toughest decisions I've had to make, but I'm aware that as an adult, as a parent, that you've got to make the tough decisions. You've got to make those decisions that no one else wants to make. The courts didn't want to make decisions. Social service didn't want to make decisions. CAFCAS didn't want to start making decisions. All these people wanted to dance around and tiptoe around the elephant in the room. But the reality, me as my son's father, I've had to turn around and say, you know what? I can't dance around and tiptoe around it. He's being abused and I need to stop the abuse.
And for me, that is the very essence, the very epitome of fatherhood, actually, I think. It's the sacrifice, isn't it?
This is it. And so, like you said, the hope is that one day he will work things out. You know, because actually, I didn't realise until very recently that I was an alienated child myself.
Yeah.
Literally, probably last few months, I twigged on. And then it actually wasn't until I had children myself that I started to sort of understand the difficulties of being parents, of being a father and a mother, and, you know, the little intricacies that you just don't appreciate before you have children.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it doesn't take him as long as being a father to understand and start appreciating where we are. But listen, all my thing is this. I love my son dearly. People say, oh, you've given up on him. Why have you given up? And I said, no, I haven't given up on my son. I've let my son go with love. I pray that he, you know, is able to find peace in the decision that I've made, and that he finds happiness in whatever way that takes. And crucially, I hold no bad feelings towards his mum. You know, and actually, I've been reading a book recently all about forgiveness, and it just talks about how it's important to both forgive yourself and other people. And massively, you know, whether my son's mum was aware of it or not of what she's done, I've had to find space in my heart to forgive myself, to forgive her, and to accept my role in whatever it is that's happened, so that I'm able then to move on without this situation sort of crushing me, you know. And I see so many men that turn to alcohol, yep, drugs, whatever it may be. So many men, you know. I sort of look at them and I'm like, you can't carry that burden, you know. Somehow you've got to find a way to release that burden from yourself. And for me, the best way I found it is through said love and forgiveness, you know, for yourself and for others.
It's interesting. Like, I've got to take my hat off to you for kind of like, you've faced a lot of this stuff, and you've kind of found ways within yourself to learn from everything and to come out of it with positivity and to take the big lessons. Like a lot of people, that just isn't possible for them. What do you think that the difference has been for you, or like, where did you learn how to do that? What do you think makes you? Big question.
It's a big question. Look, I've always had like an inquisitive mind. I've always been interested just generally in people and life. And I don't know, I just feel that you've just got to be able to, for me, is I've just been able to see what else is there and how am I going to access it? I don't know. It's just this thing about I can't allow myself just to accept a situation as it is. So if something goes against me, I'm like, well, that's gone against me, but what can I do different, you know? And actually saying that, there was a book, Anthony Robbins, Awaken the Giant Within. And my mom gave that to me probably about 15, 16 years ago. And at first I was like, what's this? And anyway, I ended up reading it on a holiday. And one of the massive things that I take from that book, is loads of obviously things in it, but one of the massive things is that was about reframing.
Yep.
And it's about how you can look at a situation and you can reframe it. You can reframe.
Reframe. Powerful, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that early on in my adult life, that was a tool that I used, I suppose, to reframe little things that were going on. And obviously, when I went to prison, it was a massive thing of learning. So I reread that book. I read literally probably 100 books, you know, and I just swallowed and consumed all of these self-help and motivational books and you know, books about life, you know, you're Khalil Gibran, you've got The Alchemist, all of these really interesting books.
Yeah, brilliant book.
You can learn these nuggets of information. And
it's the implementation, though. That's what I have to take my hat off to you, because I think a lot of people read the books, but implementing the lessons that they've learned from them is a different thing. I think one of the things I've noticed, and I would say with my coaching hat on, that I see is a massive problem. We have the cause and effect scale. So one of the things, one of the first questions I ever ask a client is, you know, where are you on that? A cause, if you're at the effect, it's where everything that happens in your life is everybody else's fault. You're a victim of circumstance. You're a victim of everybody else. And at the other end of cause, which is everything that has happened in my life and is going on and everything that I've got, it is down to me. And whether that's true or not, and there is a whole debate about people who sexual abuse, childhood, you know, and all of this sort of stuff of whether you should do it. The fact is that you can only really change when you're right up at court. Change comes when you take your responsibility for everything around you. And the words you just said there is that you just don't accept something has gone your way, but you don't accept that it can't be done differently and you can't have some power over changing that. That you're just 100% at course. You're just like, this is the situation I'm in, but I'm going to take full responsibility in turning it into something that I want it to be rather than something that I don't want it to be. And that's powerful stuff.
100%. And actually, that said, that it goes back to the situation with my son. Like, before I was able to go into that courtroom and say, that's it, I'm relinquishing all of these applications I've made. And, you know, because I probably was in a really good position to get custody of my son, but yeah, I didn't feel that was the best thing for him. So being able to basically walk into that court and take responsibility for my actions in the whole years this has been going on, and then to take ownership of the situation and actually lay down where I am and say, like, this is it, I'm now not going to see him. That was so powerful, because again, you are taking the bull by the horns and driving change and driving a direction of where things are, you know, saying, right, I now need to make this decision and then move on in my life to make other decisions. And I think you've got to give yourself that space to do that.
For sure. One of the things I talk about with masculinity is that I think masculinity, whether you're a man or a woman, you're using masculine energy to be decisive and make those big decisions. And I think it's something that at the moment people tend to shy away from making difficult decisions, that discomfort and the responsibility of that. But for me, that is everything about masculinity. It's everything about fatherhood, is about taking the responsibility, making the tough decisions when other people around you don't want to do it. So more power to you, man. Listen, we're coming to an end now. It's been packed full of value, and we've only just really touched on two of the bits that I wanted to talk to you about. Just before we wrap up, I do want to talk to you about some of the work you're doing at the moment. We've talked about Families Need Fathers. I know off air we were speaking about the Southside Young Leaders Academy and the work you're doing there. Just give me just a couple of minutes of what that work is about.
Yeah, so basically it's an academy set up 10 years ago based down in South London, and what it is an academy to help disadvantaged young black boys that, you know, don't have the opportunities in life that others might have. And what it does, it helps them both with educationally but also life skills in terms of leadership. So they do sailing, Duke of Edinburgh Awards, different training to help them develop as young men. And there's actually currently, at the moment from the academy, there are currently 35 boys that are attending boarding schools via bursaries out of London. And they, you know, and obviously there they get the opportunity to meet and both educationally get a higher standard of education, but also to socially interact and meet other young boys that come from, you know, billionaire families and multi-millionaire families. So it's a really, really interesting organisation, and doing great work, and I'm really passionate about being involved.
The social, by the sounds of it, just like literally, and speaking from, again, personal experience and from what I've seen, just sometimes taking people out of their environment and showing them that there is something different, and allowing people to not only do that, but then interact and operate and prove to themselves that they can operate in those different environments. Quite often, if you grow up in one place, you just think, oh, that's just not me. How can I possibly go over there and do that and speak to those people? They're not interested in me. But when you get that proven to be untrue at such a young age, that's life-changing stuff. You know, those guys are going to know. When you say you can be anything you want, they're going to go, actually, do you know what? I can, because I did. I went over and I spoke to those people, and we were on par. We were equals, you know. That's going to have a massive impact on their lives and what they think is possible.
Exactly. But the limiting beliefs.
Yeah.
You mentioned it earlier. You know, it's about, you know, abolish these limiting beliefs and say, this is what you can do. These are all the possibilities. And these are all the options. And just letting them run with it. You know,
there's always someone. You can always look for an example of someone that started off in a worse position than you, there's now in a better position than you. You can always find it. So the reason isn't your situation. You know, those just aren't the reason. The reason is whatever's going on between your ears. That's what separates people in different successes. Do you know what I mean? It's what's going on between their ears. Oh, man. Listen, we're going to have to... We're definitely going to do some work together in the future, mate. I'm definitely going to. I need to come down and hang out with you for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Well, look. So usually at the end, what we do is to give all our guests a little opportunity to kind of like promote themselves and what they're doing at the moment. If you need a boiler, so you set up is it a new business or?
Yeah. So we set up a new company, Avenue Heating. We're based down in Watford. Serving just local, so it's domestic work only. So we serve, you know, local homeowners in and around Watford area, Chorley Wood, Rippensworth, Hertfordshire. So we go out and said we're mainly a boiler installation company, but we do various other stuff. So that's the business basically. And we're just rebuilding. They just got an apprentice starting now. And again, rebuilding, but rebuilding the right way. So it's not like crazy like it was before. I want to have a smaller business. I'm speaking to people at the moment because there's ideas about other angles where we can go on, which will require investment. And I'm looking at, you know, the possibility of franchising an idea that I'm working on. So that's something for the future. So like I said, a year from now, we've got a whole load more stuff to talk about because it's crazy.
I'm looking forward to that.
I'm doing more work, obviously, with Families Need Fathers. My acting stuff's sort of going on in the background, doing some writing and stuff. Been doing the poetry, as you've seen from my videos.
I have. You're inspiring me, man. There's very, like, honestly, there's a few people, like, in social media world that I look on. Most people, a lot of people just make me sort of face palm. But there's a few people I follow, and every time I see something pop up from you, I always take the time to go and look at it and listen to what you're doing. And every time it's just like, what? Now he's going up doing bloody poetry. Now he's over here. He's standing outside the Houses of Parliament. What's he doing? Or even if it's just some of your little videos that you do, man. I love it. And like, properly, you inspire me, man. For real.
One thing to say, I know you've got to go over time, is this, right? I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, you're doing all this stuff. You've got too much time on your hands. And I laughed, right? And I thought to myself, no, but what you don't see is the things which I make a conscious decision what to do with my time. So
yeah,
I don't watch TV. I don't watch football. I don't do a lot of things that other people do. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't go out. I use my time in a way that allows me to do multiple different things.
Yeah.
I choose those things as opposed to what other people might consider recreational activities.
Yeah, I get the same. People go, oh, it's all right for you. You've got loads of time to do all these things because you work for yourself. And you're like, what the hell? Yeah, man, we all got the same 24 hours. It's what we do with them, right?
Yeah, exactly. So listen, if there's any investors out there that want to put some money into my business, Let's go.
A highly investable young man, Vincent. Absolutely, mate. If I had any.
it's all good. But I said, you know, any fathers that want to reach out, or and mothers that, you know, not seeing their children that want help or advice, please, you know, reach out. I'm here. Anyone that wants to collaborate on any acting, anyone that wants to get involved in poetry. Listen, I'm your one-stop shop.
Wait, I'm ticking all the boxes right now, like, you know, I'm moving down to Watford. I'm coming there.
But pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really, really interesting. Even just to verbalise things that are going through my head, it's been really interesting to have it out with you. And I'm really appreciative of having the space and the time. I hope we haven't been waffling too much and people get some value.
This has been value, mate. I'm telling you, this is like, I've spoken to some amazing people on this podcast. And I know when there's proper value and gold that's been delivered, and this is definitely one of those episodes where definitely some stuff for everybody, but there are some specific people that will listen to this that are going through different things that this could very well, there could be some pivotal information out there for them, and that's what this podcast is all about, really.
Top man.
Winston Davis, thank you very much for your time, my brother. Everybody else, thanks for tuning in to another epic episode of the Modern Man Podcast. The guests just keep coming. We keep finding these guys truly inspirational, and some girls as well. If you want to get involved with the Modern Man Club, you can find us on Facebook. That's our men only Facebook community. We do have the Modern Woman Club as well. With Saturday, the 1st of June, we're rolling out the first Man Club fitness camp in the Bristol Fitness Gym. Come and join us there, where we're going to do 45 minutes of fight camp training with myself and Jay Newton, my combat jiu-jitsu instructor. So we're going to be wrestling and punching and kicking and getting fit. And then we're going to spend 15 minutes talking about stuff, Man Club stuff. So if you want to get hold of us, modernman.org.uk, Modern Man Coach on Facebook, and the Modern Man Club on Facebook. And my name is Fidel Bohill. Thank you all for joining me, and we will speak to you all again next week.